Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, really enjoying the 4th of July program and really looking forward to this hour because we haven't done it in a while. Deacon Stephen Graydonis is back with us, often known as SDG, and you're a big deal if you're just known by your initials. And he is a big deal, a member of the New York Film Critics Circle and a deacon of the Catholic Archdiocese of Newark. That's pretty good. And you've seen his writing on film everywhere from the National Catholic Register, Catholic Digest, and everywhere else that you can write about a film as a Catholic. He's the founder of Decent Films. Deacon Stephen Graydonis, thank you for being with us.
Cy, it's great to be here with you again.
Yeah, I love talking with you about film because you have that Catholic take, but you do it at a high level. And that's the sometimes we get a little we can be a little more pious in our reflection of film and not actually reflect on the film itself. And I appreciate that you bring both skills to the table.
That is really what I wanted to do, and it's the reason that I started writing the style of film criticism that I did. I felt like I was part of these two different worlds. I was part of the religious world, and I was part of the world of cinephiles and movie fans. And I felt like I understood both in a way that often they didn't understand one another. And my goal was to write reviews of movies like, say, The Last Temptation of Christ that would enable somebody like Roger Ebert to understand why we as Catholics regarded it as blasphemous, and then to potentially write reviews of, you know, R-rated movies other than The Passion of the Christ for Christian and Catholic audiences, and maybe make the case for why we might be interested in watching them.
Yeah, because the Catholic approach to art is not a Puritan approach. And sometimes I think, especially because maybe we're Catholics in a Protestant country, we don't even know our own Catholic tradition of engaging with art in a way that's open to forms of expression that might make us uncomfortable, that might not always be, the art that would be in church. Not all art has to be church art in order to be great art.
You know, John Paul II was a huge figure for me, both in my journey to Catholicism. He was the Pope at the time, and in just in my intellectual formation. And he was also a great appreciator of art and culture. He was involved in theater in his youth. And a lot of his writings and works have been really helpful to me on this point.
All right, so and not all film is art. On the other hand, too. So we have the summer movie season. Is it as big a deal as it used to be? The summer movie. I mean, you know, there. It really maybe since Jaws, maybe before that. You'd know better than I do. There's just been this idea that the summer was the time for big movies. Is it as big as it used to be?
So movies have never really bounced back from COVID. Theaters shut down, everything shut down, and people have gotten much more used to just watching even the biggest and most high-profile movies at home on their televisions. And so there has been some effort to try to bring audiences back to the theaters. Tom Cruise's Top Gun Maverick last year was a big deal. He's got a new Mission Impossible movie coming up in a couple of weeks, and that's a big deal. The new Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse movie has been doing great box office. But on the whole, the box office these days is a fraction of what it used to be just a few years ago.
Well, the quintessential summer movie is Raiders of the Lost Ark, and we're getting a new one. We're getting a new Indiana Jones movie.
Raiders of the Lost Ark is not just for me the quintessential summer movie. It's one of the defining movies of my life. I was 12 years old when Raiders of the Lost Ark opened in theaters, and it was just a perfect blend of action and thrills and a religious element, which for me as a devout young Christian, not yet a Catholic, but certainly a Christian, that was a big part of it. And it struck a chord in me in a way that I already loved movies. I already loved going to see them. But Raiders fascinated me in a way that made me want to study it and take it apart and understand it. It's significantly because of Raiders of the Lost Ark that I'm talking with you here today. And as you say, there have been a number of sequels. There were two others in the 80s, Temple of Doom and Last Crusade, which is a big film for a lot of our listeners because of the Catholic element. And then the two more recent films, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and now Dial of Destiny.
Okay, so we'll get to the Dial of Destiny, but I the experience of Indiana, of the first one, Raiders of the Lost Ark, in the theater, it really seemed at the time, and I was a kid when I think I was a little older than you when it came out, like movies are back. And I don't know enough about the history of film to know why it felt that way, but I can remember there was a feeling of this is something that had been missing maybe throughout the 1970s or something. And why is that? Why did it feel, and I don't think people alive today will get this, but it felt like, oh, movies are back when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out.
So Steven Spielberg and George Lucas had been pioneering a style of nostalgic cinema. You mentioned Jaws, and Jaws was certainly the first in this trajectory. George Lucas's Star Wars was another one. Lucas in particular, I think, had a lot of nostalgia for older genres. Star Wars was inspired not only by old serial science fiction adventures like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, but also by World War I and World War II dogfighting scenes, by Akira Kurosawa, by hot rod cinema, by so many things. And then he and Steven Spielberg came together and they made Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right.
And on one level, it's an homage and a tribute to a style of serial adventure movies from the 1930s and the 1940s. It started in their minds as a series of set pieces, and they hired screenwriter Lawrence Kasdan to stitch them all together into a story. So many things, though. This is a movie, Raiders is a movie, that the rightness of it is hard to explain in a way that it's hard to explain why Casablanca is so great. Because so many things came together in a way that hadn't been part of the plan in the beginning. They, like Indy says in Raiders, I'm making it up as I go. And they really were kind of inventing it along the process. And for me, I think a huge part of the reason why this movie is kicked up from just being great adventure cinema to being transcendently great adventure cinema is the theological dynamic in the film that comes about when you make a movie about Nazis versus the Jewish God, the God of the
Ark. Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. There's a dimension to this that is necessarily theological. You can't do a movie with Nazis against the God of the Jewish people without it having a theological level to it.
And it's so interesting to me how this kind of taps into two of the elements of each of the filmmakers. You know, George Lucas has always been interested, you know, think of Star Wars and the Force, in the idea of mysticism and the supernatural, and putting that in movies as a metaphor in some way to evoke awe in viewers. And then Steven Spielberg, who didn't grow up super Jewish, has always been trying in his movies to kind of reconnect with his Jewish identity. And I think here you have a fundamental case of those two impulses coming together. A well-known critic in the 1980s, when the movie came out, dismissed the movie as blowing up. Actually, no, I think it was Ebert. Ebert talked about it as, and he loved it. He talked about it as a movie about blowing up the bad guys real good. But this is really about the Jewish God blowing up the ultimate anti-Semitic villains real good. And Indy, the hero, is tied up and helpless in the climax, which dramatically is a very strange thing to do. But as you watch Raiders over and over, you'll realize more and more, Raiders of the Lost Ark is about a hero, a solid action hero, very competent, very strong, very manly. But his defining characteristic is that he fails. He fails over and over again. He doesn't get the idol from the Hovitos in the opening sequence. He doesn't get the Ark of the Covenant. He doesn't succeed in rescuing Marion when she's kidnapped. He doesn't succeed in getting the Ark back with the bazooka. He fails over and over and over, and it's God who takes action in the end.
Wow, I'm so impressed with I really appreciate that reading of this movie, because you can kind of do the Roger Ebert thing and say it's just about, you know, blowing up the bad guys. But now there is an element to this, however. When you pit the Jewish God against the Nazis, you do something that maybe I as a kid growing up in the 70s, began to notice was missing from the movies, which is have clear moral lines, that there was a kind of amorality to the movies of the 70s or a shifting morality. I don't know how you would describe it.
So certainly there was a kind of jaded cynicism in a lot of the films of the late 1960s and early 1970s. I think that there is a moral element, but you have to approach it. It's not going to come out and spell itself out to you. So you watch a movie like Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather.
Right.
And this is a movie about very amoral people and also about a world of artificial morality, about a world in which you can be a good family man and love your wife and play with your children and your grandchildren, and then have this other life where you're, you know, selling drugs or running numbers rackets and wiping out your enemies as your child is being baptized.
Right.
So what I think is the difference between these two movies is that a lot of the more jaded, sophisticated films of the 70s, in a way, are about damnation. I think that The Godfather is story. The Godfather films, the first two films in particular, are the story about the spiritual downfall of Michael Corleone. And then the new movies like Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, are about, on some level, they're about redemption.
That's a very, very interesting point. You know, the visual clue in Raiders of the Lost Ark for me, as a, I don't remember, I was probably 16 when it came out or something. The visual clue that this was a movie that was restoring the movies was the maps. The fact that, do you remember how the maps go where, like, they'll show the airplane kind of flying across the map? This was a very 1930s look. And it is kind of meant to say, this is an old-timey movie. This is not one of these 1970s kind of dark and ambiguous films.
Absolutely. And there is there's an immersiveness to that world that you don't find, for instance, even in a film as nostalgic as the 1978 Superman with Christopher Reeve. Christopher Reeve himself is a real throwback. When he identifies himself to Lois Lane, he calls himself a friend. And he says it was very important to him to say the line that he's here to fight for truth and justice in the American way. But it's a movie that juxtaposes that with 1978 cynicism.
Right.
Lois's response to that line is, ha, you're going to be fighting every elected politician in the country.
Right.
There is a cynicism to Raiders of the Lost Ark, but it's the same cynicism that you find in a movie like Casablanca. It's a movie about a jaded hero who is self-interested and sticks his neck out for nobody, but who over the course of the film experiences some kind of epiphany. In the end, what he really wants is to rescue Marion. He doesn't even want the Ark. He wants to rescue Marion. He can't do that either. But his goal has changed. He's become more interested in a person's life than in the history, even on this iconic level that has dominated his entire life.
All right, we got to take a break. So I want to ask you about, because I love the way you talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark. I want to ask you about the new Raiders of the Lost Ark movie, and we'll do more summer movies with Deacon Stephen Gradonis right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What a great grace it is to have the opportunity to use the airwaves for the honor and glory of God, to be able to talk to the hearts of individuals and meet them where they are in their relationship with our Lord, and also to encourage them forward.
Women of Grace with Johnette Williams, this morning, 3 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's striking hearing you talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark because you were 12 years old when you saw it. And I'm thinking about something that happened to me when I was 12 years old, that someone put in my hands the Tolkien book, The Lord of the Rings. And it changed my life forever. And it's amazing, at a certain age, the art that gets impressed on you is really formative. Artists are very, very important.
Yeah. We are creatures of intellect and reason, but we are also creatures of imagination. We're cultural creatures. Stories and images matter tremendously to us. The Lord of the Rings, also an extremely formative text in my life, along with the Chronicles of Narnia, and an awful lot of movies, yeah. Raiders of the Lost Ark being one.
So before we get into the new Raiders, or the new Indiana Jones movie, is called what? What's the name of the new one coming out?
Or so this out? this one is in theaters now. Yeah. It's Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. It has two distinctions. It's the first film in the series. It's now five films, which was actually part of the original plan. Lucas and Spielberg wanted to make five films, and now they almost have, except it's not directed by Steven Spielberg. It's directed by James Mangold. It's not based on a story concept by George Lucas the way that all the others were. And it's the first film in the series in which the paranormal artifact, the aforenamed Dial of Destiny, also called Archimedes' Dial, is not in any way religious. So there's been a religious theme in all of the films to date, and it's been pointed out, a friend of mine noted many years ago, that if you watch the films in the original trilogy, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and then Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, if you watch them in internal chronological order, in Indy's life, his first supernatural adventure involves pagan supernatural power, polytheistic power in a Hindu context. The second one is Jewish, the Ark of the Covenant, and the third one is Christian, the Holy Grail. Oh. So there's a kind of religious progression through his life in that original trilogy in the 1980s. Now, we have these two, they sometimes call them lega sequels, or nostalgia sequels that are made much after the fact. So Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came 19 years after Last Crusade, and then 15 years after that, we now have the Dial of Destiny. And in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the supernatural element is kind of new agey alien super technology tied into pre-Columbian religion, psychic powers, crystals, and all that. So that's kind of a regression. And then now in this film, we're at the point of no religion at all.
So with these things that go on and on and on like this, sometimes it seems like the law of diminishing returns comes in. It's not possible to grab that magic again that they didn't. But some people do it. I mean, if you think about The Godfather, I think the second one is better than the first one. Like, it's so there's not the law of diminishing returns there. Is that the case with these Raiders movies? Are we just kind of squeezing the last drops out of a almost dried fruit?
Just to piggyback on that thought and put in a plug for another upcoming movie, there is a franchise that's been around since the 1990s that I think has only gotten stronger over time. And that's the Mission Impossible franchise. I am not particularly a fan of the first three movies.
Right.
But starting with Ghost Protocol, I think they've just gotten better and better and better. And I really, really enjoyed the new one, Dead Reckoning Part 1. We'll talk about that later in the show if we have time.
Okay.
But in a nutshell, yes, I think that the creative inspiration for the Raiders sequels has consistently gone downhill. A lot of people enjoy, and I enjoy, Last Crusade more than Temple of Doom. But I think you could argue that there's a creative energy in Temple of Doom that exceeds Last Crusade. We can talk about that if you want. And then in these two latter day sequels, these nostalgia sequels, although there are things about both of them that I like, and particularly the very strong opening scene of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and then the climax of Dial of Destiny, I do think that the returns have been diminishing. And they say this is Indy's last ride, and I'm very glad for it.
Oh, yeah. Well, do they do the de-aging thing in this? This is all the rage now with the old actors. Scorsese did it very well, I thought. I don't know how you felt about it in The Irishman. But is that part of this whole thing?
It is. And there's I don't know if it's 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but there's an extended prologue in the beginning of Dial of Destiny that puts us back in World War II in 1944. And Indiana Jones and a colleague played by Toby Jones are trying to get their hands on mystical artifacts that the Nazis are looting. And there's a kind of a feint to the world of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, because one of these artifacts is the Spear of Destiny. This is the partner of the Holy Grail, the Spear of Longinus, the Roman soldier stabbing Jesus in the side. This has a big role in Arthurian legend, just like the Holy Grail. But that's just misdirection. This movie is really interested in something called the Antikytheria, which is it's a name for a real artifact, an artifact that really exists. It wasn't built by Archimedes. It was built by another Greek mathematician. And what it was this incredibly complex clockwork gear. They call it
analogical computer. I think is where you're going. Yeah.
they call it an analogical computer, and what it can do is predict the motions of heavenly bodies decades in advance.
Yeah.
So that includes predicting eclipses and things like that. That's not very exciting for an Indiana Jones movie. And so Archimedes has built a device that predicts rifts in time.
Oh.
So it will allow you to travel to different periods in time. And the bad guy in this movie, played by Mads Mikkelsen, is an aging Nazi who wants to go back and change World War II so that the Nazis win.
All right. So does the movie work? Or like you said, it has diminishing returns. Maybe you're not going to give us a review of it. I don't know. You don't have to if you don't want to.
No, it's fine. I'll give you my take. So here's the counterintuitive thing. I think that the climax of this movie, where we see the Archimedes dial in action, is, I think it's the best payoff for one of these artifacts after the original Raiders. So I think that the Sankara stones in Temple of Doom and the Holy Grail, we should really talk about that one, why that's a disappointment. And the Crystal Skull, none of them really deliver for me a truly satisfying finale. But if you take Archimedes' dial for what it is, it kind of does. I like what they do with it. It's something we've never seen in a Raiders movie, but it works for me. It works for me in a way that some of my favorite Star Trek or Twilight Zone episodes work, which is not what we expect from Indiana Jones. But, you know, I'll take it, especially as a movie that, for the most part, while I was watching it, I found kind of disappointing. Yeah. Partly because you don't have Steven Spielberg. I mean, only Spielberg is Spielberg, and you can't blame James Mangold for not being him, but the movie is what it is.
Yeah.
And then there's just also this level of nastiness running throughout the movie with a body count. You have these villains who just go through the movie, leaving a trail of innocent or good people in their wake. And while the movie obviously isn't endorsing what they do, you know, I'm here for escapism, and watching people that I like or people who are nice just die throughout the movie is not necessarily my idea of a good time, unless you have a movie that's going to pair up with some kind of really redemptive finale, which is not here.
Oh, I gotcha. I wonder. I am curious about why the Holy Grail doesn't pay off. What's your problem there?
Right. So this is a really, really big thing for me.
Okay.
Because I love Arthurian literature, I have been immersed in it all my life, and I love the Holy Grail and the Spear of Destiny. But you have filmmakers whose instincts are to go for thrills and action and chills and things of that sort. And these were things that they knew how to do with the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is holy and it is perilous. And the Old Testament gives them the template. Uzzah put out his hand and touched the Ark and he was struck dead. 70 people looked into the Ark and the Lord smote them. So that gives you a template.
Yeah.
There's nothing about the Holy Grail in the New Testament. So that's like right off the bat. And then in Arthurian literature, it's this very kind of ethereal, hazy property. It comes down to this. The filmmakers did not know what to do with the Holy Grail. They knew how to use the Ark of the Covenant. With the Holy Grail, all they could think of to do was surround it with kind of stupid and arbitrary death traps.
Yeah.
And then this whole false grail business, I think there were better solutions that they missed.
Stephen Gradonis is our guest. We're talking summer films with the deacon who knows all about film. We'll continue that conversation right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I think we got away from doing the summer movie thing with Deacon Gradonis. It was during COVID. Like there was no reason to do it, and then we haven't gotten back to it. But I'm really glad we're back to it. It's so much fun to get to talk movies with you, and I know that Raiders is a seminal movie for you. But I hope you'll be all right if we move on now, because there are more movies of the summer.
There are other movies I'm excited about and that I want to talk about.
Yeah, and you were mentioned to me at the break. Barbie's coming later in the year. Oppenheimer's coming later in the summer. There's big movies to come. But last year, do I have my years right? Last year, Tom Cruise had the big movie with Maverick, and maybe Tom Cruise will have the big movie again with the new Mission Impossible.
It's entirely possible. Mission Impossible is now his big franchise. It is the property that kind of brought him back from the brink. In the 2000s, he really stumbled in a lot of ways. He had his meltdown talking about various Scientology related elements, his relationship with Katie Holmes and jumping on Oprah's couch. All of that was controversial. But starting with Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol, He began to craft a new identity for himself. And that identity was quite simply the performer who is willing to suffer for your enjoyment.
That's a great take. And I love him for it. Yeah.
And so do I. So do I have to say, and this is something, so I'm not going to give up talking about Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark yet, because Harrison Ford pioneered this in Raiders. Now, other actors had done their own stunts before, and we've had other Hollywood tough guys. But what was interesting about Indiana Jones, in contrast to somebody like James Bond, who was a model for him, was that sometimes Indy got punched and it hurt. Like, he winced and he fell over and he stumbled in action, and afterwards he was like aching and complaining, and we'd never seen a Hollywood tough guy do that before. And really, starting in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which was directed by Brad Bird, the great Brad Bird of The Incredibles.
I didn't know that connection. Oh, he is a great director then. Yeah.
So we see suddenly that Ethan Hunt is fallible. Ethan Hunt is afraid to make that jump off of the hospital ledge in Russia into the dumpster. And when he figures out a better way to get off of that ledge, it's brilliant, but he doesn't quite stick the landing and he gets hurt. He's like stunned. And you know, he has even like pratfalls and gets confused. And it's that willing, we know that Cruise is really doing these stunts and sometimes really getting hurt.
Yeah.
And there's something about that commitment. And the way that I think about it is this: movies are illusions made up of little pieces of reality, but those pieces of reality are important. They establish a rapport between you and the performer. It means something when you see Hugh Jackman in a movie singing and dancing, and you know that he's really dancing and he's really singing. That's his gift to you.
Yes.
And Tom Cruise has a gift to offer in these movies. And, you know, there's all kinds of things we can say about Tom Cruise, but that is one thing you have to give him.
I am so glad you said that, because I'm a Tom Cruise fan, and I was not always a Tom Cruise fan. And I think it's funny, because I don't think as deeply as you do about these things. I just kind of have feelings. And I do think the Mission Impossible movies changed my feelings about him. And then when he strapped himself to the outside of an airplane, and it was not CGI, the dude strapped himself to the outside of an airplane, I thought, oh, he really loves movies. Like, he wants to make this an experience where you go and you're like, you can't breathe, because is he going to fall off that airplane?
And it's so interesting to me that he's willing to do this. Nobody else could do it. Nobody else has the credibility to get other actors to do it, to commit to the kinds of things that he does. He has the dedication and the commitment, and he cares about the craft. And you know, there are lots of things about Tom Cruise that I do not like. He is the most visible face for Scientology, which is a terrible and abusive organization. And he's probably not always a great person to work with, although that varies from person to person. But the reality is that people are complicated. People contain multitudes. People contain contradictions. And the same person can have genuinely good and genuinely bad aspects to their personality. And neither is necessarily the whole truth, and neither is necessarily false.
Yeah.
And you know, Tom Cruise may or may not contain multitudes, but there's definitely there's a few dudes in there.
He might not be Walt Whitman, but he's close.
And one of them knows how to make really entertaining, non-ordinal sequels in action adventure movies, and I love the result.
Yeah, I'm so glad, because sometimes I talk about this on the air with our president Chris Check, and he's like, Tom Cruise, and he'll go into all the Scientology stuff. But my feeling is,
which,
like,
we should absolutely talk about.
Right. It's fair game, but I'm not in a movie thinking about that. Like, I absolutely love Errol Flynn in Captain Blood. Like, I think that movie is trash without him. And he can absolutely carry a whole movie. I know Errol Flynn's a jerk. I know that. I mean, that's been well documented. Or I should say, a person with intense personal problems. But I'd rather watch Errol Flynn than almost anybody else on the movie screen. That has nothing to do with his lifestyle.
And we can, you know, we can go back to artists throughout history and talk about, you know, Caravaggio murdering a man over a tennis game and then look at his conversion of St. Paul. So that this is a contradiction that we have to struggle with, and we have to say separating the art from the artist is important, but you can never completely do it. There is always going to be a tension there. There are always going to be artists whose personal lives are problematic in a way that prevents me, at least, from enjoying their work. You know, it's very hard for me these days to enjoy Bill Cosby, for instance.
Oh yeah,
and,
right.
And partly that's because enjoying Bill Cosby depends on me liking him and having that rapport and connection with him. I don't have to like Ethan Hunt to respect him and to value what he does. There is also a moral theme that has been worked into the last few Mission Impossible movies that I think is interesting. In the most recent one, in Mission Impossible Fallout, Ethan Hunt becomes defined as a person who cares as much about one life as a million lives. And we see that put to the test when he's put in a situation where, for the sake of the greater good, for the sake of saving millions, he might have to be willing to kill a few innocent people. And he won't do it. He'll find another way. And then there's this very touching scene where an innocent person, a woman police officer in Paris, stumbles into a situation where her life is in danger. And he works so hard to keep him safe. You know, whether that compassion and that kindness comes from Tom Cruise's heart or it's the character that he's created, it's moving to me.
Yeah. And those dilemmas make for really good movies. Like the fact that you're willing to put your character in those positions, that makes for really good movies. The other thing about a Tom Cruise movie, though, especially these Mission Impossible movies, there are a lot of movies where I see the trailer and I go, yep, I'm going to watch that when it comes out on video. I'm not waiting for Mission Impossible to come out on video. I want to see it in the movie theater. I want to see the stuff blow up. I want to see him hanging from the outside of the plane in a screen that's bigger than my house, on a screen that's bigger than my house.
And yes, I have seen Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, part one. There's a part two coming, I think, next year. At this time, I am still under embargo, so I can't officially review it. I can tell you that I really enjoyed it. And I can tell you very generally that there is a very interesting humanistic theme to the movie, humanistic in the good sense, the Catholic sense, meaning that there are anti-human forces in the movie that Ethan Hunt and his Mission Impossible Force are working against. They're working to save humanity from dehumanizing forces. And in the age of artificial intelligence in which we live, the conversations that this movie is having are very much a part of the conversations that we're having in the real world. You know, what is the place of humanity going to be in the age of not just GPT-4, but ChatGPT-10? People are already asking questions like, you know, will a computer someday write a movie review so well that it takes my job away? Will it someday write a homily so well that I don't need to be able to write a homily anymore? My opinion is that it's a long way from being able to do either of those things, and especially writing the homily, because I think the homily, as a deacon, a homily has to there has to be an authenticity to it flowing from your own relationship with God. You know, when I became a deacon and they put the word of God in my hands and they told me, believe what you preach, you know, there has to be that fundamental integrity of faith, the way that you live and the way that you preach. And without that, the homily is not going to have the power to convert anyone. So I'm not seeing that coming anytime soon, but it doesn't take the question away. People are still asking the question.
So and Mission Impossible deals with these dehumanizing tendencies. This new movie does.
Yes, it does. Okay. It's a part one, so it ends on a cliffhanger. But it's also a battle over the question of how much power is too much power for any one person to have. So. Moral questions at the heart of the film.
Oh.
Great stunts. If I say any more, I might get dinged for reviewing the film.
Yeah. I don't want to do that.
But let's get together again sometime after it opens and talk about it again.
If I ask a question like this, you don't have to answer the question. I just wondered, would it violate the embargo to answer it? Like if I were to say something like, well, does Tom Cruise jump off of anything ridiculous or strap himself to any machinery that a human should not be strapped to? Like, is that the kind of question you're not allowed to answer in the embargo?
It's not violating anything to say there is a stunt associated with this movie that has been all over the internet and all over YouTube.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
It involves a motorcycle and a canyon wall.
Okay. Oh, I got to see this movie. Okay, we're going to take a break. All right, I have all the information I need now. I have all the information I need to know that I'm going to see Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. More on summer movies with Deacon Stephen Granados right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, Heavenly Hints.
Read any good ones lately? You know, those inspirational words in your church bulletin or that scripture in the readings, a phrase from a hymn? Don't just copy or clip to leave forgotten in a drawer or book. Make them at home in the most mundane spot you know, inside the cabinet door or clothes hamper, tucked away inside your handbag or the tissue paper holder. God lives everywhere. His words should as well.
A Heavenly Hint from EWTN.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. You can find about Deacon Granados and his work in reviewing and sharing insights, really deeply Catholic insights into films at decentfilms.com. Is there anywhere else I should send people besides decentfilms.com?
So I'm mostly writing for Catholic World Report these days,
but
all of my reviews are at Decent Films. And if the whole review is up at Catholic World Report, there'll be a link to it from there.
All right. Very, very good. A member, you should know, of the New York Film Critics Circle, which is a quite elite circle of film critics, and also a deacon of the Archdiocese of Newark. So qualified in several areas, as they might say. All right. Spider-Man. First of all, the greatest superhero. Spider-Man is the greatest superhero ever created.
Hands down.
Oh, really? Oh, I get an amen on that. Okay, very good. Very good.
Spider-Man also, very formative. I cannot remember any time in my life when I have not been a Spider-Man fan, going back to earliest childhood.
Yeah, and it's weird because he's not the most powerful. He's not. I don't know what it is that makes him the greatest. In part, I think it's because he's in a neighborhood. I actually think that's like he's your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. But I just love him.
I mean, for me, I was kind of quiet and bookish as a boy. I was shy and I got picked on. And I saw in Peter Parker things that I connected with, but also things that I wanted to be, because Peter becomes brave and confident and he uses his power for good. And I wanted to do those things. So there was an identification there. Later on, reading his comic books as an adult, married to the woman of my dreams, and reading about him being married to Mary Jane Watson, I had a strong connection there as well. And then they did something where they undid his marriage in a kind of time clippy thing, and I stopped reading.
Yeah, because it is kind of like, what other superhero lives with his aunt and then marries his sweetheart? I mean, there is something really nice about that. So I am not familiar with the Spider-Verse films. I think it's two films now.
It is.
Tell me about it.
And so, first of all, Cy, I am here to tell you, sometime over the next week, you should find a way to watch Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It's 5 years old, 2018 movie, and it is the best Spider-Man movie I've ever seen, but it's also it's my favorite animated movie of at least the last 10 years.
Wow.
And maybe my favorite superhero movie of all time. It's produced by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are also the producers of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and the Lego Movie. So they have a wonderful sense of style. They reinvent the look of their movie with every movie they do. But there are also solid moral themes at the center of all of their movies. And I want to highlight one in particular that I think a lot of our listeners will connect with, which is the importance of the father-son relationship in the movie. Now, a lot of animated movies follow a theme that I've dubbed Junior Knows Best, where the child has to rebel against the father and break the rules and then succeed and win the father's approval and respect retroactively. You know, I am going to train these dragons and not kill them. I am going to go to the surface world and marry the prince. I am going to go out on the ocean past the reef where I'm, that's a, you know, but Into the Spider-Verse is a movie, first of all, where dad knows things that the kid doesn't know, specifically about his uncle, who's a role model. But then also, it's a movie where the child comes to a place of helplessness and paralysis, and the father comes to him with a word of encouragement and affirmation and faith that enables our hero to rise up and overcome. So it's not first the child wins and achieves, and then the parent approves. First, the parent supports, and that enables the child to succeed. That's a theme common to two of their films, not just Into the Spider-Verse, but also Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Very interesting to watch them side by side.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because the treatment of fathers in media in general, it not just films, but in media in general, there's a real ugliness about the way fathers are treated for some reason.
It is a very serious issue, and it's a serious issue in animation and in family films, not just because it's more prevalent than in other forms of media, but because the movies that children watch over, like the themes that they see in one movie after another, kind of form their moral imagination, kind of give them a script that they then play out later in life. So I think it is very important to have movies like Into the Spider-Verse, where we see concerned, caring, compassionate parents who really want the best for their kids, who may not understand them 100% of the time, but who really do have their best interests at heart, and whose relationship with them is, you know, makes it. So at the end of the new film, at the end of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, our hero Miles Morales says that it's his parents that have made him strong and that have made him who he is.
What a movie theme for today, huh? Wow. So what about this law of diminishing returns we were talking about? You don't seem to feel that there's a letdown in this second movie.
There could have been, because Lord and Miller, as much as I love their work, they have made two sequels in the past, and neither of them has been as good as the original. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2 and the Lego Movie 2. Neither of them really adds fundamentally to the first film. But this time, they were determined to do it. And they have pulled out all the stops, like Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. This is a part one. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Next year, God willing, we will see Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse. So it ends on a cliffhanger, but it is all about themes of connection between people, of finding your way in life, but not in the kind of egocentric way that so many other cartoons are about. It is about family bonds. It is about loyalty between children and parents. And both of these films are just, they're so beautiful, the way that, you know, as Catholics, we believe in the three transcendentals of beauty, truth, and goodness. These are ways that God reveals himself to us. And in the beauty of a film like Across the Spider-Verse, God is present to me.
That's so exciting, because we started by talking about what Raiders of the Lost Ark meant to you as a 12-year-old. There's some 12-year-old out there now watching Spider-Man across the multiverse, or and having the same experience, and having an understanding that art is an introduction to a dimension of life that's worth living in.
I have seen this with my own kids. Among the many things that I'm very grateful to God for is that I was able to raise my children in the era of classic Pixar. So, for instance, my oldest son has a very profound relationship with the movie The Incredibles. He's loved it all his life. but it's also meant something different to him at each stage in his life. You know, there was a stage in his life where he saw himself as Dash, the young boy. There was a stage in his life where the relationship between the children and the parents was central to him. Then he began to see things in the father, and then he reached the point where he realized that this movie is about a midlife crisis, and this movie is about fears of an adulterous affair, and about, you know, the meaning of a life and the nostalgia when you realize that the dreams that you hoped to achieve may not be there for you later in life. And the depths with which he loves that movie, it's something that I'm very grateful for.
Well, sometimes we try to do that by making movies about religious things. And I know there's a new movie coming out called The Miracle Club about Lourdes. Not all of these attempts are successful. As a matter of fact, sometimes they're stunningly failures in trying to awaken religious awe. I won't ask you about that movie, but it does. I want to ask you about Lourdes related movies. There's a bunch of them, from Song of Bernadette, maybe even before that. I might see this movie, The Miracle Club, but tell us about Lourdes and films.
Sure. So let me just say, first of all, I'm very interested in The Miracle Club. It looks to be a comedy, and so spirituality and religion are probably not going to be front and center. It's going to be like some movies that I've seen about the way, about the Camino de Santiago.
Oh, right.
Some movies treat it like the Emilio Estevez movie, The Way. There's a religious subtext, but it's fundamentally a religion. It's fundamentally a movie about human relationships. And I suspect that The Miracle Club will be like that. Religion may be an element in the film, but it's not going to be central. But there are other movies. I've just written a chapter for a book that talks about two of them. The Song of Bernadette, 1943, is one. And then there's a 2009 film by a filmmaker named Jessica Hausner, which is much more skeptical and at a distance, but deals with something in the movie that could be a miracle. There's a woman with multiple sclerosis who does experience an extraordinary recovery, and there's a lot of discussion in the film about whether it's a real miracle and what it would mean for it to be a miracle. And I find both of these films really fascinating and interesting because, for me, they open up our minds and our imagination to the question of how do I recognize God's action in my life? What in my life is a sign? And if I see something as a sign, is that wishful thinking? Is it like pareidolia, like seeing faces in clouds, or is there, can I be confident that I see God moving in my life? And what are the things that make me confident? Watching a movie like The Song of Bernadette, which is, it's a pretty good, pretty faithful adaptation of Bernadette's life. There is another film about her by Jean Delannoy from 1988, starring Sidney Penney, just called Bernadette, which is much more scrupulously faithful to her life. But both good movies and both edifying, and I enjoyed the 2009 Jessica Hausner film as well. There's also, a couple of years ago, a documentary by a pair of French filmmakers called Lourdes that just follows some pilgrims in the shrine, and you know, they range from very pious people to a group of sex workers that are brought to the shrine by priests who have a ministry of doing this, and we see their kind of journey, and we see how, you know, some of them, you know, convert and their lives are changed, and others of them aren't so changed, but they're trying, and they keep coming back. And there's a question of, is there a miraculous setting of Mary in the movie? It's a documentary that's very much worth seeing. It's also called Lourdes. It's 2021, I believe.
Deacon Stephen Graydonis, thank you. Thanks very much. I'm very worried about the future of film because the screen actors, no, not the actors, the writers are on
the
strike.
Writers.
So, but we may not be able to do these film conversations for much longer.
That is a very important conversation, and it goes back to that theme that we were talking about regarding Mission Impossible and the dehumanizing forces in the world. One of the things that's at the heart of that writer's strike is whether AI will be able to get credit for screenplays.
Scripts, yeah.
Writers don't want them to.
Check them out at decentfilms.com. decentfilms.com. It's very nice to have you back. Thanks so much for coming back, Deacon Stephen Graydonis.
Si, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Maybe you'll come back when the Barbie film and all these other late summer movies come out. I got to know, am I supposed to see Barbie or am I not supposed to see Barbie? All right, you'll have to tell me. And but I hope you'll be available. We'll get you back and do the late summer movies.
All right, thanks a lot.
Hey, happy 4th of July to everybody. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.